Johnson et al. Versus City of Suffolk et al. L. Stephen Emmert, Joseph T. Waldo.
Has left the conference.
G. Terman, Appellant's Counsel. David L. Arnold, Ross Green, Christopher Pomeroy, Paul Neifler, Matthew Hull, Appellee's Counsel. Please allow 1 to 2 minutes for this transfer to take place.
Has joined the conference.
All right, Justice Millett will be sitting for Justice Kelsey on this case. Mr. Emmert, you have 20 minutes. You may begin.
Mr. Chief Justice, counsel has not yet been transferred into the courtroom.
All right, well, bring him in.
Will do, sir. Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, it appears that all the parties are present and accounted for.
All right. Senior Justice, Millett will be sitting for Justice Kelsey on this case. Mr. Emmert, are you going to argue for the appellants?
I am, Your Honor.
You have 20 minutes. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and in this appeal, I represent oystermen who have leases in the Nansemond River to plant and to harvest oysters. The doctrinal origin of this case goes back 100 years to the bad old days when, because of technological differences, it was a practical necessity of life that raw sewage would be dumped into our Commonwealth rivers. As it is, times have changed, but the city and the district in this case are still now clinging to a way of life that doesn't exist anymore. Society has moved on. Most important, the law has moved on, and we'll be talking about how that law has changed today. I propose to be merciful to you. I'm not planning to repeat the arguments that I made on brief. I'll just deal with a few arguments that the appellees have raised in their arguments, and then indicate where I think this case fits within our jurisprudence. First, it's important to remember that this is a physical invasion case. This is not a case of a regulatory taking. So the argument that the district makes in its brief that we have to show, as a practical matter, a deprivation of all economic use simply doesn't apply. This is a physical invasion, so one invasion equals one taking. Next, a matter where I've pleaded, as you saw in the assignment one, or assignment A, I should say, in there, the difference between state and federal law. Now, the argument that I've received in reply is that it doesn't really matter, the same law applies here. And maybe that's right. It's conceivable that that's right. But I do recognize that our damage or take language in Article 1, Section 11 creates far greater rights than the Fifth Amendment, which only talks about taking. What I didn't want to do was, by not assigning error to what I perceive was the circuit court's ruling based on federal law, waive the right to ask for you to apply a body of Virginia jurisprudence. We pleaded this case in the circuit court expressly and exclusively under Virginia law, not the federal constitution. The city makes an argument in its brief that there's a difference between upland property in the cases that we cite, Livingston, McDonnell, HECS, and the subaqueous bed of an oyster bed. But the law doesn't reflect that difference. As we cited in the definitions section that we quoted in our brief, 25.1-100, I believe, property is defined as simply physical, as either personal or real. And we saw in the Ballard Brothers case that you regard oyster beds as being personal property that is subject to being taken or damaged. So that issue, I think, is gone. Once the Ballard Brothers case decided that issue, at that point, we know that oyster beds are capable of being taken. They are property, and the law doesn't recognize a difference between subaqueous and upland. The appellees argue that the laws that we cite, the constitutional provision and the statutes that we cite, aren't self-executing. And honestly say that in an eminent domain context, this is low-hanging fruit. Article 1, Section 11 is the execution method for all claims of inverse condemnation. It really most sincerely is self-executing, as you've held time and time again. So while those claims set forth what the public policy of the Commonwealth is and prohibit the kind of activities that the city and district are engaging in here, this is the means of enforcing for someone who suffered a taking or a damaging of their private property rights. And that brings us to the public trust doctrine. In this case, in preparing for the argument in this case, yesterday I took the time to reread Commonwealth versus Newport News. I emphasize that I took the time because it's a very long case, a very long opinion, and it contains a number of very, very fine legal distinctions between what kind of rights exist as the jus publicum, public rights, or the jus privatum, private rights. But reading that convinced me that we're right as the claim of whether this right in issue here is one of the jus publicum. That's found on page 554 of the Commonwealth versus Newport News opinion, 554. And that's where you specifically say that pumping raw sewage into natural waterways is a matter involving jus publicum. The very next page in that decision, page 555, provides additional guidance for your decision in this case. In that, page 555, the opinion notes that the General Assembly had met 9 times between the issuance of the Darling opinion in 1918 and the issuance of the Commonwealth versus Newport News case in the early 1930s. And you noted, your judicial ancestors noted, none of us were around then, your judicial ancestors noted that the General Assembly in all those times had not seen fit to change the ruling saying that localities were free to pollute. Well, we know what happened next. In 1938, the General Assembly did just that. They promulgated the state water control law that prohibits localities and anybody else, as a matter of fact, from using the public waterways as a public sewer. You couldn't do it anymore. Other laws have followed that. There's a 1946 Declaration of the Public Policy of the Commonwealth that also now exists, by the way, in Article 11, Section 1 of the Constitution. It may also be in Section 2. So in this way, we know what the public policy of the Commonwealth is as expressed by the body that has the right to set that forth.
Counsel, help me with that issue, because there could be a regulatory regime where polluters, whether it's air pollution, water pollution, some other kind of pollution, have restrictions, there's a permitting scheme or whatever, and it restricts, and they can be fined, they can be prosecuted, all that. But when does that bleed over into my property right? So if there's a regulatory regime that embodies the public policy of the Commonwealth, at what level does that translate into me as a citizen? The air over my house is unclean. The water in the creek out back is polluted. I have a private right of some kind, whether it's taking or something else. And it's a thorny issue. So help me understand how that turns into an eminent domain problem.
In addition to being a thorny issue, I think it's a factual issue. It's for the jury to decide whether your property has been damaged or taken. In this case, the jury should have been able to hear that because of the gushing of raw sewage over these oyster beds, that the property rights of these oystermen have been taken. In your example, if you have, let's say, an air quality issue that affects your home, then a jury has to decide whether that's enough of a taking or damaging that it deserves just compensation.
But that presupposes that in my bundle of rights, you know, we have the right to alienate, we have the right to lease, we have the right to exclude others. There's all those bundle of sticks we learn about in law school. And so then the question is, part of my bundle of sticks, does that include sewage or clean air or whatever? Now, when I have a fee simple interest, I think we know the answer. But here we're talking about leased oyster beds, and that may be different from fee simple.
It wasn't different in Ballard Brothers. In this case, there were leased oyster beds that this court found were private property that was subject to being taken or damaged by the actions of a local government. In that case, you found that because the right had not been taken away by the General Assembly, I'm referring back to Commonwealth versus Newport News. In the Ballard Brothers case, there had been a trial. And this court found that there was ample evidence in which a jury could have found that there was proper damage. Now, when we go to trial in this case, as I earnestly hope we will, then the oystermen are going to have to prove the effect on their property. But we have a pretty good indicator of the fact that there has been constitutional damage by the repeated and intermittent closures of the river for harvesting purposes. When these things happen, as happened 6 weeks ago, as you saw from the Department of Health orders that I sent you, these oystermen are out of business. They're shut down. And for an extended period of time, they have no income. Now, I think we got a pretty good chance of establishing, based upon those closures, the condemnation by the health department, that we have a constitutionally recognizable claim for injury.
But yeah, I understand the factual point, and we get juries to sort that out. I'm getting to the legal question of what bundle of rights does a leased oyster bed get? And one default principle is from these older cases. Meanwhile, we have a new regulatory regime that is more protective of environmental concerns, but that doesn't necessarily translate into an individual right of action. And so therefore, to what extent do they have that in their bundle of rights? I don't think it's a factual point. I think it's a legal point.
Well, I don't believe that there is a difference in eminent domain between a leasehold right and a fee simple right. We allow damages I had one recently in the Fernandez case where there was a claim made by a tenant. And this is a claim that was litigated and you decided in the Ballard Brothers case. I don't know if I'm missing the point that you're trying to make, but in my view, the Ballard Brothers case answered that contention. Yes, leased interests are subject to that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay. In this case, the city and the district have purposefully operated systems that they knew would cause untreated raw sewage to gush over this private property. At this point, I believe that this case is the opportunity for this court to say that we've moved on from the bad old days that I described. This can be, indeed it should be, a watershed case in our jurisprudence. Maybe I'd call it a clean watershed case. But this is the case where the court can say that in this case, this ancient and foul practice is no longer a part of what Virginia tolerates. We're better than this. We should be better than this. May I have leave to respond in the time remaining to me?
Yes, 9 minutes. All right, for the appellees, I understand you've agreed to split your time along the parties that have been sued in this case. Mr. Green, for the City of Suffolk, you have 12 minutes. Mr. Pomeroy, for Hampton Roads Sanitary District, you have 8 minutes. The clerk will adjust the clock accordingly. Mr. Green, you're up first.
You're on mute.
Yeah, there you go.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Ross Green, counsel for appellee, the City of Suffolk. Your Honors, I disagree with our friend Mr. Emmert's interpretation of Darling, and I think that is at the core of this particular matter. The trial court correctly applied Darling here, Your Honors. If the appellants state a cause of action for inverse condemnation, which we contend that they don't, for various reasons that we'll get to in further assignments of error, then that claim is barred by Darling because of the particular facts here. This does not involve uplands or dryland, and it's not that property generally as upland property or subaqueous bottom is somehow different generically. It's that the property interest here is distinctly legally different. These are leased subaqueous bottoms, property of the state, leased to private individuals, the appellants, in derogation of common law. And this legal point is analyzed in detail in both Darling cases and several other cases cited on brief. These are leases in derogation of common law, and the oystermen do not own a fee simple title. They have a very, very limited bundle of sticks. Essentially, they only have the ability to use that leased bottom for the propagation of oysters. And Darling goes into this analysis in detail. I think our friend Mr. Emmert is conflating the issue.
Counsel, your friend on the other side says Ballard answers the question.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I think Mr. Emmert is conflating the issues there. Ballard was a formal condemnation of subaqueous bottoms at a time when the statute specifically granted municipalities and localities the authority to formally condemn subaqueous bottoms. So that can be condemned, and then there is a discussion of whether or not the oysters on it can be condemned that goes into some issues about property. But as far as the subaqueous bottom itself, which we're referring to here as oyster ground leases or oyster leases, that is a very, very limited bundle of sticks, and it only contains this essentially one right that the court goes into in Darling, and really nothing else. So we're not talking about a complete property right in a fee simple upland title, which is what the court is discussing in pretty much every other case that appellants are citing. When they're talking about Livingston, Kitchen, AGCS, and various other recent court jurisprudence about inverse condemnation, what they're talking about is a owner that has fee simple title, has the complete bundle of sticks, has the ability to exclude others. That notably is the thing that's missing here, Your Honor. Really what they have is the extent to keep is to exclude other people from harvesting their oysters, other fishermen, when you look at the statute. And the statute that deals with this grant in derogation of the common law has not substantially changed since Darling. This statute has had very little change except for the controlling change for this case, which is in 2014, the General Assembly took away the right that municipalities previously had to condemn this type of property interest. Leased oyster beds specific.
Counsel, this is Justice Mims. I'm well aware of the statutory progression. What I'd like to tease out for maybe more than one question is the constitutional progression. There was not an environmental article in the prior Constitution, but there is one in the 1971 Constitution, as all of you are well aware of, because it's been cited several times in the various briefs and amici briefs. By any chance, did you read Professor Howard's commentaries in the context of Article 11 and in the context of this case?
I have not read those particular commentaries, Your Honor.
Okay. Because I'm fascinated by, and again, Professor Howard doesn't sit on this court, but I certainly respect his views on such matters, and he is often cited to us on questions of the Constitution. And his chapter on Article 11 deals at some length with the jus publicum, but in particular, it points out that that Article 11 confers citizen standing. And that a court, and I'm quoting now, well, I believe this is a direct quote, a court faced with an Article 11 case will have to fashion a remedy appropriate to that particular case. And I'm just curious about the continued validity or continued weight of Darling in light of the fact that Article 11 of the 1971 Constitution is far from aspirational. It certainly appears to have teeth in terms of both citizens being able to come into court, and in terms of the courts being able to fashion particular remedies. So, long question or series of questions. I'm asking it of you, and I will not repeat it of your co-counsel, but I would ask him to respond during his time as well.
Yes, Your Honor. The city's position is that changes in the Constitution and in environmental laws here, which have reflected changes to make discharges into the public waters of this type unlawful or illegal or not part of the public policy, serve to defeat a claim for inverse condemnation here. What Darling stands for is if you have a lawful proper authorized discharge of sewage into the public waters, which is what the municipality had there, essentially all of the elements that you would otherwise have for an inverse condemnation claim, because the oysterman takes subject to the risk of lawful pollution of the waters, they still don't have an inverse condemnation claim.
My question might not have been sufficiently precise. If in fact Darling no longer binds us because of Article 11 of the 1971 Constitution, where do we go from there?
Your Honor, my position here is that even if Darling were to no longer good law, which I think it still is, given that it's based on the limited bundle of sticks, not just the environmental issue, Your Honor, you still have, in this case, appellants missing numerous elements required of an inverse condemnation case. They don't have, for example, municipal authority to condemn. It's taken away by the General Assembly. They don't have a valid public use. In Darling, you have a different historical situation in which discharge of sewage into the public waters was considered a valid public use. If you accept the various items cited here as far as the Constitution, the State Water Control Law, the Clean Water Act, etc., what you've got are no longer allegedly legal discharges. You have the appellants asserting an illegal use. And as the courts previously identified in AGCS and other cases, illegal or unlawful uses don't constitute public uses for purposes of setting forth a condemnation claim. It's not just that you have alleged property damage attributed to a government entity. It has to satisfy various elements, including being for a public use. And if it's illegal and against public policy and not permitted under all of these different things that counsel have cited, then you don't have a valid public use on which to base an inverse condemnation claim, is the city's contention, Your Honor.
So, and as I recall, there's some argument that there are other remedies available?
Yes, Your Honor. That Mr. Lockerbie on the LGA's amicus brief explores this in some detail as far as potential claims for nuisance, trespass, injunctive relief, and notably injunctive relief, Your Honor, is not available vis-a-vis an inverse condemnation or formal condemnation claim. Those claims are limited to money damages, so they don't actually afford a remedial protection. There are numerous claims potentially available here, Your Honor. It's worth noting that appellants have pursued none of them. They deliberately chose and only pled an inverse condemnation action under the specific inverse condemnation action statute. They have not, you know, allegedly, obviously we contend they don't meet the elements of that, but that is the only claim for relief that they have attempted to pursue in this case and none of the others, Your Honor. So our position would be any claim that there is somehow a lack of available relief is overblown and has not been pursued in any way. I think, Your Honor, that Mr. Emmer, to go back to the point I was exploring earlier, is conflating Ballard Brothers and this situation when they are completely different situations. The municipality doesn't have a general condemnation authority. It only has the authority that it's been delegated, and that authority is what it must use to have a condemnation. Whether the condemnation is inverse or formal is a distinction without a difference. And we contend that they fail to state a public use, that the oyster leases don't guarantee them purity of water or the ability to exclude the state waters on which their oysters, in fact, depend. As we cited on brief, oysters depend on fecal, depend on the contents of the water to live. And while appellants claim issues with fecal coliform, oysters, in fact, thrive on fecal coliform. With regard to our remaining assignments of error about the police power and the statute of limitations, Your Honor, we would rely on our brief. And to the extent that I have any time remaining, I would request to yield that time to Mr. Pomeroy, counsel for HRSD.
Well, you have 13 seconds, and it doesn't work like that anyway. Mr. Pomeroy, you have 8 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Pomeroy, and I represent the Hampton Roads Sanitation District. And it's been my privilege for over 20 years to help HRSD use its Enabling Act authority from the General Assembly to upgrade the regional wastewater system. HRSD now treats water for 1.7 million people in 18 cities and counties across Hampton Roads. And thankfully, manufacturers and industry and military bases and others across densely developed Hampton Roads have made clean water progress too. Much has been accomplished, yet with so many people, residential septic tanks, state highways, private farms, it remains the case now, as when Darling was decided, that pollution does in fact reach tidal waters every day of every year. So the issue is not about that progress or the work yet to be done. In my view, this is part and parcel of a long-running public policy dispute about the terms on which the Commonwealth chooses to offer leases of its submerged public lands to private parties like the litigants here. We've understood for over 100 years that those leases come subject to the risk of pollution and not with a guarantee that the leased area be free from. And I'm working my way to Justice Mims's question in these comments, Your Honors. Because the General Assembly did not authorize by statute, and the VMRC, the Marine Resources Commission, did not purport to convey rights by lease, that stick that we're referring to is not in the property rights bundle for purposes of an inverse condemnation claim. And rather than taking this long-running policy issue for a head-on decision in the General Assembly on the other side of Ninth Street, you all have been asked by these litigants to reinterpret the terms on which the Commonwealth has already entered into these leases. And I would submit respectfully there are three major problems with that argument. The first is from a construction standpoint, we know the leases must be strictly construed against their private interests because they're grants and derogation of the common or public rights that are represented and account for all of the upland land uses across Hampton Roads. All rights, as this court said in 1984 in Working Watermans, that are not specifically granted are necessarily reserved to the Commonwealth. The second problem for the appellant's argument is that they have really failed to identify a clear and explicit statute needed to meet their burden and put their interests over those of the public as a whole. They've, in some of the provisions that have been referenced at argument already today, they've really invited the court to look way back in time. The state water control law was mentioned as 1946, I believe Mr. Emmerich said, to find what we still submit is an unwritten pure water guarantee. You can't find it, you can't read it. As to the constitutional provisions that and the questions posed to counsel for Suffolk and myself, I'd submit on that point. You know, we did address those. I'd refer the court, please, to pages 20 to 21 of the brief, where we do have a discussion of the fact that Section 1 and Section 2 are not have been decided by this court not to be self-executing. Similarly, there's a policy statement in the state water control law, also not self-executing. So you get down to the nuts and bolts of the permitting program and that regulatory regime. Which we operate and live with every day. You've seen some discussion of what that entails in the papers. The key point here is in the state water control law and the water quality laws of the Commonwealth, the General Assembly has never granted general citizen standing to act as private attorneys general, there are some comparable provisions in different federal environmental statutes that are not at play here. But as a matter of Virginia law, the General Assembly has never granted citizen standing to prosecute those regulatory regimes against upland actors who may impact water quality in one.
Council, this standing analysis would be marginally different from that. This is not a citizen coming in seeking citizen standing to simply to uphold the public trust. This is somebody coming in saying my particular economic interest has been harmed. An economic interest that I entered into by contract with the government itself. Is that not distinct?
Justice Mims, thank you. I don't see that. I guess I'll just offer, and I've not read the particular commentary on the point in a long time that you referred to, but I'll just offer that in my full-time water quality enforcement practice, these claims have never been prosecuted in that manner in the Commonwealth, out of my experience. I don't see that having just been used or supported, despite the many times that the Article 11 is frequently referred to for the high aspirations that we all strive for. It seems to me that the General Assembly has directly addressed this point with an explicit statutory structure that really runs counter to what the lessees are asking. And that's one where the legislature has balanced the interests of all sorts of Virginians, including the thousands of upland landowners, where they have granted, they've given the VMRC the authority to grant these leases despite known widespread contamination across the Chesapeake Bay and all the tidal waters for merely $1.50 per acre per year. And at the same time, they charge the health department with the authority to close those lease grounds whenever the health department decides it's appropriate to do so to protect public health. And then left for the lessees, nevertheless, the option with health department's permission to move the oysters, for example, during that 10-day closure period in late October to a different location if the watermen cannot wait. So there's a structure on the books that balances these competing interests already. So in closing, HRSD is clearly for clean water. They work tirelessly every day. We would submit that the public policy issue here, if there's been an awareness yet no change in the General Assembly, it would not be appropriate, we submit, to reinterpret the leases at this point to add the pure water right. So we requestfully respect that the Circuit Court be affirmed and the appeal dismissed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Mims, has he answered your question?
Indeed he has. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Emmert, you have 9 minutes to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try not to use all of them. Actually, before I begin the substantive part, I want to mention one thing while I still have time to do it. You see us, the advocates here, in our public face. You don't see what goes on behind the scenes. And so I want to assure you that in our dealings, both Mr. Green and Mr. Pomeroy have been extraordinarily professional in this case, and I want to commend them for that. You don't know that, but that's what's happened in this case. Let me deal with Ballard Brothers. First, there is a specific line in Ballard Brothers on page 673 of that opinion that holds specifically that oysters are personal property. And this court cited that specific ruling 3 years ago in the AGCS case. That was at 293 Virginia 491. So this court has very recently reaffirmed that oysters are the kind of property, even though they're leased grounds, that can be condemned or inversely condemned, as we've cited from all the line of other cases. Really, the only answer that the polluters have in this case to those is that they're uplands cases, and it's not the same as subaqueous. Well, the statutes define what property is for condemnation purposes. Section 25.1-100 defines property as any right, title, interest, estate, or claim in and to land or personalty. Well, there's a lot to choose from there, and I think I can at a minimum say that we have a claim to the oysters there, and you have already ruled that those are personal property. As far as the suggestion that the city made that we have other avenues, I'm not about to cede to any defendant the right to write my pleadings for me, but what I can say is that the avenues that they've suggested, things like, for example, trespass, those kind of things, are subject to a lot of fearsome immunity defenses. I know because I was a municipal lawyer for 9 years and asserted those defenses in defense to those cases. Also, there is no exhaustion requirement. We don't have to go through other remedies in order to get to this. The law affords us this avenue. The Constitution does, and the Declaratory Judgment Act certainly carries that out. As far as whether this is a difference between an affirmative condemnation and inverse condemnation, that gets down a hole that I don't know that the appellees want to chase, because it implicates, as we pointed out in our reply brief, the very constitutionality of the statute that they're shielding themselves with. The Constitution says you can't take or damage people's property without paying just compensation for a public use. We can all agree, by the way, that sewage and stormwater control is a public use. But what they're saying is that because the General Assembly has taken away a certain affirmative right of condemnation, that they're now immune from this inverse condemnation. That can't be the case. That's simply not the law. And as we've pointed out, all of the case law that we have otherwise so indicates. There's one thing I'll mention, and that's that as far as we can tell, and by we I'm including the very smart full-time eminent domain lawyers that I consult with, as far as we know, this statute that prohibits the affirmative condemnation may be sui generis. It may be the only instance in the code where the legislature has said you can't condemn this particular kind of thing. But as we know, the statute can't countermand the Constitution. Finally, I'll address Justice Mims' question because I think we know the answer to it. The change in law since Darling is the heart of this appeal, and it's decisive here. Back in the old, what I call the bad old days, it was a practical necessity that localities had to do that. But times have changed, and the law has changed along with it. The law specifically said, you can't do this anymore. But as we've seen, they are doing it anymore. So, it's 2020, and right now we find ourselves in a position of trying to drag the city and the district, kicking and screaming, into the second half of the 20th century. That's when the laws had firmly established that they couldn't do what they're continuing to do as recently as 6 weeks ago. It's time. Thank you for hearing me today, and all of you, be well.
Thank you for your arguments.
Has left the conference.